all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. Rain is likely today with highs in the upper 40s, breezy winds from the east 10 to 20, then shifting from the southwest this afternoon. We could see a rain-snow mix overnight with lows in the upper 20s and breezy southwest winds. For tomorrow, we do have a chance of snow, less than 1 inch accumulation most likely, highs in the low 30s and gusty west winds. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. And programming is supported in part by Jennifer Ivanza Insurance, an official MNsure partner. It's an open enrollment season, and Jennifer Ivanza Insurance is here to support the Chisholm and Hibbing communities with health plan enrollment and guidance. More available by calling 218-254-3422 or by visiting thenetworkmn.com. Thanks for listening to KAXE. We continue now with Morning Edition.
I'm from NPR News in Washington. I'm Corva Coleman. Former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz is facing scrutiny over his fitness for the job as the next U.S. Attorney General. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports there are renewed allegations against him, central to a House Ethics Committee investigation.
The House Ethics Committee was investigating Gaetz over allegations including sexual misconduct and illicit drug use. Joel Leppard, an attorney who represents two women who testified before the committee, says one of his clients told the panel that she saw Gaetz have sex with a minor at a party in July 2017. He also says his clients told the committee that Gaetz paid them for sex. Leppard is calling on the committee to release its report on the investigation. Gaetz has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing, and a spokesman for the Trump transition called the allegations baseless and said they are intended to derail the second Trump administration. The spokesman said Gaetz is the right man for the job and that he will be the next attorney general. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The Kremlin says Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a change in the country's nuclear doctrine. It will allow Russia to consider using nuclear weapons if it's hit with a massive air attack. The change comes as President Biden approved Ukraine's use of U.S.-made long-range conventional missiles to hit parts of Western Russia. The White House has not officially announced this change in policy. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, notes that today marks 1,000 days since Russia invaded Ukraine.
For 1,000 days, the people of Ukraine have not broken or bent. But while today is an important marker, there's nothing special about this somber occasion.
She notes that Russia continues to attack Ukrainian infrastructure as winter approaches. President Biden is asking Congress for nearly $100 billion in emergency disaster aid. It's for people facing crises such as Hurricane Helene, which hit in late September. Residents of Asheville, North Carolina, can get clean water out of their taps again after the storm damaged their water system. Laura Hackett of Blue Ridge Public Radio has more.
It's been over 50 days since Asheville residents have had clean drinking water. After Helene caused severe damage to its water system and completely muddied the reservoir, the city struggled to put the pieces back together. They've used everything from chemicals to industrial curtains to clean up the water. And now, finally, the wait is over. Dina Larson is one of the many Asheville residents who is rejoicing over the news that clean water has returned.
There are definitely tears of happiness, much sooner than anyone expected.
Larson says she hopes that water will help Asheville enter its next chapter of recovery and lead to the city's economy bouncing back. For NPR News, I'm Laura Hackett in Asheville, North Carolina.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The National Weather Service says a powerful storm is aiming for the West Coast and should arrive by tonight. The atmospheric river could bring wind gusts to northern California, Oregon, and Washington state that are close to hurricane strength. Heavy rain is forecast, and weather forecasters are warning of storm damage and power outages. A new survey from Pew Research Center finds that one in five Americans get their news from social media influencers. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the researchers say influencers have become a key alternative to traditional news outlets.
Pew found that among young people, the trend was especially pronounced. For adults between 18 and 29, nearly 40% turned to personalities on TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram to understand the world. These influencers tend not to have journalism training, but many have amassed audiences that rival leading news outlets. Pew also found a clear ideological bent. On platforms such as Facebook and YouTube, the number of right-leaning influencers exceeds left-leaning ones. And the authors note that news influencers are more likely to be men than women. But across parties and gender, the survey found surging demand for influencers to deliver and explain the news. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Lizzie Borden is at the center of a trademark case in Fall River, Massachusetts. Borden was famously acquitted of the axe murders of her father and stepmother in the 1800s. A ghost tour group that owns a bed, breakfast, and museum at the Lizzie Borden house sued its neighbor, Miss Lizzie's Coffee, for trademark infringement. A federal appeals court sided with the coffee shop and says the name can stay. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Michael Goldberg, host of the weekly show Stay Human. Coming up on Sunday, December 15th, we're hosting an afternoon of live storytelling, stories of endings, and stories for the end of the year. Starting at 2 o'clock at Clocko Brewing in Grand Rapids, some of the folks who've been regulars on Stay Human, and some irregulars too, will have a brew and a story for you. And it's an open mic. Bring a story to share if the scene and the beer inspires you. With support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, it's Stories for the End of the Year, Sunday, December 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at Clocko Brewing. Hope to see you there.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in New York City.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll talk about cutting government spending. Many presidents have said they want to. President-elect Trump is the latest. We'll ask a longtime advocate for responsible government spending why that hasn't happened. But first, today marks 1,000 days since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of its neighbor, Ukraine.
The war forced the displacement of millions of Ukrainians from their homes and led to the death and maiming of hundreds of thousands of civilians and soldiers. But the war has, of course, also brought immense changes to life in Russia.
NPR's Moscow correspondent Charles Mace is going to talk about this. He's reported out of Russia since the beginning of the conflict. Hello, Charles.
Good morning.
So, Charles, I take it the question isn't whether Russia has changed as a result of the war, but how much?
Yeah, you know, the truth is this war has transformed Russia completely. Everything from its geopolitics, you know, where once Russia sought acceptance, albeit often angrily, from the West, now it has military alliances with rogue states like Iran and North Korea. Also look at its domestic political culture. You know, Russia under President Vladimir Putin was never a liberal democracy, but the repressions and near total crushing of dissent since the war started make the earlier Putin era seem comparatively free. And then there's the economy. Today, Russia is the world's most sanctioned state, but those are largely Western-imposed sanctions. Big-name Western companies like McDonald's, Apple, Starbucks have all left Russia. But the country has pivoted to new markets and new trade partners, often in China. So the result is that what you eat, what you buy, what you say, read, and watch, it's all changed.
That sounds kind of disorienting. Do we have a sense of what Russians think about this? Is there any way to know if they really support the war and how they feel about all the changes it's brought?
Well, the government claims that Russian society is united behind the war effort. Some state polls will show the same, although keep in mind the repressions that we mentioned. And through reporting, I've certainly met people who clearly buy into Kremlin propaganda, that this is a war against fascism, that Ukraine is run by neo-Nazis. And they see it as a continuation of the Soviet Union's fight against Nazi Germany in World War II. You know, for example, here's tape from a conversation I had with a man named Andrei Nikolaevich, who I met on Red Square last year.
We have already had once this victory in 1945. And we expect peace, but peace should be with victory over the Nazis, new Nazis, who occupied all the country of Ukraine.
Do you worry about Russian forces killing other people, though, like innocent civilians, too?
No, it's all fake, because we don't kill human beings that are peaceful. We kill only the soldiers.
You know, Michelle, that said, let's remember tens of thousands of Russians fled the country in opposition to the war. Thousands more have gone to jail for civil disobedience. And in conversations I've had just day to day, people who aren't government critics or politically active tell me they just wish the whole thing would end.
And of course, now President-elect Trump will be returning to the White House. He's promised to negotiate with Putin. He says he will quickly end the war. How is this seen from Russia? Are there prospects of peace seen from Russia?
Well, I think it's fair to say there's a surging confidence in Moscow with Trump's suggestions he could end military support to Ukraine. President Putin this morning formally approved changes to Russia's nuclear doctrine, expanding the list of threats that might warrant a nuclear response from Moscow. It was a clear message to President Biden's decision this week to allow Ukraine to use American long-range missiles to strike deep inside Russia. And I think one that raises the question of whether Putin has any intention of compromise going forward.
That is NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Charles, thank you.
Thank you.
Here in the U.S., a massive overhaul of the federal government is being promised. It's one of President-elect Donald Trump's big campaign pledges to take a big axe to what he and his allies consider wasteful spending. He's tapped billionaire Elon Musk and former Republican presidential contender Vivek Ramaswamy to lead what's being called the Department of Government Efficiency. Musk claims they'll be able to cut $2 trillion from the nearly $7 billion federal budget. To get a sense of how that could be done or even why, we've called Maya McGinnis. She's president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, is a think tank that supports cutting federal spending and lowering the national debt. Maya McGinnis, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
From your perspective, what is the problem that needs to be fixed? Is it that the government spends too much or maybe does too much, or that it uses debt to pay for its spending? Because those are not the same things.
They're not at all. We're a bipartisan organization, and we look at it as we borrow too much. And you could say we need to cut spending to borrow less. You could say we need to raise taxes to borrow less. You could be a big government or a small government person. We are neutral on those things. We just think the fact that we borrow to pay our bills, which undermines our economic strength and our ability to respond to emergencies like COVID or recessions and our national security, and frankly, it leaves us vulnerable to some kind of a fiscal emergency down the road, we think that that is ill-advised and short-term policy. And so we advocate against using borrowing for paying our bills, except when there are emergencies and it's the right time to do so for economic reasons.
Okay.
But we've gotten to the point where we just do so politically because no one wants to pay for things.
Interesting. Okay. So let's go to the president-elect's pledges. Elon Musk, whom he's enlisted in this effort, claims to be able to eliminate $2 trillion from the federal budget. As we said, it's nearly $7 trillion budget. I'm trying to figure out how the math works, because mandatory spending is about 66% of the budget, according to the 2022 budget. Then there's interest on the debt, which we just talked about. Discretionary spending is like 26% of the budget, and a large part of that is defense. So can he do that?
Yeah, $2 trillion out of a $7 trillion budget. Wow, that is a heavy lift. And I think it will be much wiser to put a kind of reasonable metric and try to truly meet it. A lot of times we talk about budget numbers over 10 years. $2 trillion over 10 years would make a lot of sense. But the truth is, mandatory programs, defense, healthcare spending, all those things have to be on the table, because that's some of the biggest areas where there are waste, fraud, abuse, inefficient program spending. So the first rule is don't take anything off the table. Look at that $7 trillion budget. Look at regulations. Look at the way our computer systems talk to each other and think about where we can have efficiencies. But something well short of $2 trillion in a year is more reasonable and would be a huge win if we were able to find ways to do that.
And now, to that point, Republican and Democratic administrations have said that they want to do that. They want to cut government spending, or they want to cut red tape. Why is this so hard?
Yeah, because every person's, any bit of waste in the government has a very strong constituency. Even programs that are outdated, don't work, don't do anything that we need anymore, there's somebody benefiting for them, and that somebody has a louder voice than the rest of us as taxpayers or the people who are suffering from long-term budget deficits are not going to make as big a deal about it. And so you have to realize that the programs, even if they're not done efficiently, they're incredibly popular. Redoing a bureaucracy, clearly something that's long overdue, but that's going to have effect on real people, real lives, and real workers. So it's not pain-free, which is why the government's basically given up on budgeting and not made choices. I think a set of fresh eyes would be really useful, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking this will be easy and just getting rid of, you know, things like shrimp racing funding. It's going to be real programs and it's going to be real people.
Before we let you go, I do think it's fair to point out that Trump added his administration added $8.4 trillion to the debt in his first term. What would you like to see happen in the ideal world?
And you make a really important point, which is you can talk a big game, but when Trump was in office last time, he made the debt worse, not better. And so we have to realize that the first thing to do is you pass a budget. You can't take anything off the table. Our biggest areas of waste are in healthcare, in national defense, and in tax breaks for the well-off that run through the tax code. So you need to look at all of those programs. And I think we need to make sure that we get our computer systems actually working and talking to each other, update the technology that's used for this. And again, this needs to be part of an overall budget, rethinking of our national priorities. Let's not take a meat axe to the budget, but let's really look at every item and see what they can do.
That's Maya McGuinness. She's president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya McGuinness, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Later today, Elon Musk's company, SpaceX, is set to conduct another test of the largest rocket ever built. As NPR's Jeff Brumfiel reports, environmental concerns have slowed the rocket's development, but with President Trump's election, that may be about to change.
It's called Starship, and it is a monster. It's taller than the Statue of Liberty. Every time it launches, it sends out a deafening shockwave.
30 seconds into the flight, the rumble's just starting to reach us here at launch control.
The launch site is located in the middle of state and federally protected wetlands. Biologists have documented that the sound and heat damage the eggs of nesting birds. SpaceX wants to launch every other week, but it's been slowed by the Federal Aviation Administration, which is conducting an environmental assessment. And earlier this year, the Environmental Protection Agency fined SpaceX because water used to cool its launch pad was allowed to run off into the wetlands without a permit. Those sorts of holdups may be about to go away.
We will land an American astronaut on Mars. Thank you, Elon. Thank you. Get going, Elon. Get that spaceship going, Elon.
That was President Trump speaking at a rally in Tempe, Arizona last month. Lori Garver is a former deputy administrator at NASA. She says she anticipates that the agencies overseeing SpaceX are about to become much more hands-off.
I think the biggest difference in the next year is on the regulatory side.
Those careful assessments of Starship's environmental impact could be swept aside in the new administration.
The FAA and the EPA will not be raising flags as they have been these last couple years.
If regulators do less, a larger role could go to the courts. Jared Margolis is a lawyer with the Center for Biological Diversity. His group is leading a lawsuit against the FAA because they claim environmental regulations are already not being properly followed.
They might try to get away with more, which might mean we need to add more to our case.
Margolis says his group is ready to challenge SpaceX and the government.
We're not afraid of confronting the Trump administration. We're not afraid of making sure that environmental laws are being complied with. That's what we do.
But Trump's win will likely make SpaceX a lot more powerful. Tim Ferrer is president of TMF Associates, a firm that analyzes the space business. He says SpaceX already has billions in government contracts to launch satellites and provide services.
Musk's influence will presumably only boost that dominance.
This launch of the world's largest rocket is a powerful reminder of how this election has consequences on Earth and beyond. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's 6:19. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for more with Heidi Holton and John Latimer. We'll hear student phonology talkback starting at about 6:45. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. Online at timberlakelodgehotel.com. And we thank UPM Blend and Paper, integrating bio and forest industries into a sustainable and innovation-driven future. More at upmpaper.com. Good chance for rain today, highs in the upper 40s, breezy winds from the east 10 to 20, then shifting from the southwest this afternoon. Chance of rain snow mix overnight with lows in the upper 20s and a chance of snow tomorrow. Accumulations less than 1 inch, highs in the low 30s and gusty west winds. We receive support from the Rife Center in Grand Rapids, presenting A Christmas Carol on Monday, December 2nd at 7 p.m., featuring the classic tale of redemption following Ebenezer Scrooge on his journey from nasty curmudgeon to warm-hearted saint. Tickets available at therife.org. Loon Country Quilters meets tonight at 6 p.m. at Grand Village in Grand Rapids. Helen Adamson will present a program on her 365-day challenge quilt. Let us know if you have a community event to share. Email us, psa@kaxc.org. There's more ahead from Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, committed to moving the world forward and working to tackle some of society's biggest challenges. 9 campuses, one purpose, creating tomorrow today. More at iu.edu. From C3AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprises using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. From Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Americans have had a hard time talking to each other lately. Politics these days emphasizes division rather than unity. So we've asked reporters across the NPR network to explore how people in this country are communicating and what some are trying to do to bridge divides. Today we visit a community chorus in Colorado doing both the musical and political work to sing in harmony. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports.
1, 2, ready,
act. It's a Wednesday night at a spacious, contemporary-looking church on the edge of Paonia, a small town in western Colorado. The 40 or so members of the North Fork Community Choir are running through their regular warm-ups.
Really pay attention to that.
Music director Stephanie Hellickson is listening carefully to how the singers' voices blend. The details matter in an art form that's all about achieving harmony. Hellickson, who comes from a musical family, has spent most of her life in Paonia. She says harmony is important, not just musically, but also socially.
Because we're all coming from different backgrounds and different perspectives, and we're coming together to do something together, we have to learn how to not agree with somebody, but still work with them.
The North Fork Community Choir is based in a part of the country where the politics are all over the map.
We've got people from pretty far right to pretty far left in the chorus.
Choir member Jan Tuin has been living in the area since 1964. His dad, an auto body repairman, moved the family from near Denver in search of a slower pace of life. Over coffee at a hip new bookstore and cafe in downtown Paonia, Tuin says the mining, farming and ranching families who've been around for generations have in recent decades been joined by an influx of artists, winemakers and remote workers in fields like tech.
So the people here now are much more diverse, I would say.
Nearly everyone in the choir is white, reflecting the area's racial demographics. But the members range in age from 11 to 87. Some of the singers believe in God, others do not. Some own guns, others do not. When the choir required masks and or vaccines for rehearsals at various points during COVID in accordance with federal recommendations, some were happy to comply, but at least one member quit. Tuin says people avoid bringing up potentially controversial topics during rehearsal.
We talk about our gardens a lot.
No matter their politics and values, all of the 20 or so singers NPR spoke with for this story say they focus on music making as a uniting force and as a way to at least temporarily forget differences. This includes choir members Mary Backron, the recently retired mayor of Blue Leaning Paonia.
We make harmonies together. It's just so wonderful.
And Chris Johnson, the recently appointed mayor of Red Leaning Crawford, a nearby ranching community.
We're just all there to sing.
Yet the music itself sometimes draws the differences out. Take the choir's Broadway programme back in the spring. It involved medleys from well-known musicals such as My Fair Lady, Rent, Pippin, Dear Evan Hansen, and West Side Story. This number might be one of the most famous in the American musical canon, but some of the lyrics describing Puerto Rico as an ugly island rife with disease and poverty did not sit well with singers like Ellie Roberts.
And I really struggled with that because it sort of implies that Puerto Rico stinks and why wouldn't they leave? You know, and it just sort of encouraged some of those stereotypes.
Roberts, a local school teacher, says the group discussed the issue at rehearsal.
What are we celebrating and what do we not want to celebrate?
They thought about changing the lyrics, but ended up doing the song with a disclaimer music director Stephanie Hellickson made from the stage.
Again, we have to think about context for this piece. This piece has some things that are maybe not as acceptable in today's day and age as they were when it first came out.
Meanwhile, other members of the ensemble brought up a different concern. This one had to do with a raucous showstopper from Les Miserables, Master of the House. In the song, a CD innkeeper and his entourage of petty criminals invoke Jesus as they fleece their customers.
It bothered me because I did not want to use the Lord's name that way.
Singer Kim Johnson, who's a Christian counsellor, says she and some members from the group discussed the matter with Hellickson and came up with alternatives to singing Jesus.
I sing Jesus. C-H-E-E-S-E-S.
Hellickson says she knew the Broadway program would be a little bit provocative.
It's pushing boundaries that some people are not comfortable with in our little rural pocket of America. And so part of programming some of this music is to actually have those conversations. So we don't just assume that everybody's the same as us and everybody believes the same things and acts the same way.
If your objective is to just get a group of people together to sing well, forget about everything else in the world. Maybe you don't need to encourage those other conversations about politics. Maybe you could just avoid it altogether.
New York University sociology professor Eric Kleinenberg studies how people gather and connect, both within and across ideological lines.
But if your objective is not just to make beautiful music, but also to create a more decent society and to bridge differences where you're also using the relationships that you build while making music together as a foundation of trust to advance a conversation about something like politics, I think that could be an amazing thing.
In a small way, the issues that arose with the Broadway concert point towards this aspiration. Choir member Chris Johnson, for example, says he didn't personally have a problem with West Side Story, but he doesn't fault those who pushed for the disclaimer.
I don't think that explanation was necessary, but it's okay.
And Linda Talbot says her mind has been expanded as a result of the faith-based objections other singers in the group had to Les Mis.
I think I'm much more aware now of what could be objectionable to certain people. I don't think I thought about it. There it was in front of me. I wanted to sing it, and I did.
Hellickson says she would like to continue to program more material that inspires these types of conversations. In the meantime, the ensemble is prepping for a pair of upcoming holiday performances of Handel's Messiah.
Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
The singers say the music is challenging, but so far it's not been too controversial. Chloe Veltman, NPR News, Paonia, Colorado.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. For the Lord God omnipotent reigneth.
This is NPR News.
People in Gaza say that Israel is using a new kind of weapon against them, little drones that carry guns and target like snipers. Experts say this might be the future of war.
The reality is this is an evolution in the character of war. So I don't think we're going to turn around and go the other direction.
I'm Juana Summers. That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. It is almost 6:30. John Latimer is joining me in the studio on this dark Tuesday.
Yeah.
November 19th. Here we are.
It was so dark, I got an inexact reading on my rain gauge, but I'm somewhere in the neighborhood of 3/4 of an inch of rain overnight.
There was a lot. It was constant sound. I heard.
It was... Every time I kind of stirred in the bed, I could hear the rain hitting the tin.
Yeah. It's looking like rain through our day today. It's going to get windy again. Could gust up to 40 or 45 miles an hour.
Whee!
40 to 47 for our temperatures today. Tonight, evening lows in the mid to upper 20s. We do have a chance of snow moving in tomorrow, but that is in the Grand Rapids area kind of getting less and less likely. And even when we thought it was possible, it was less than an inch. So, but we may see some snow tomorrow and tomorrow night.
I'm just looking quickly through the records. There's only a couple of times, I think I've got four dates in the last 45 years, where the first snowfalls occurred in November. And so we are definitely pushing the records. And 11:28 in 94 and 11:29 in 2007.
Hmm.
So 11:08 in 2014.
Wow.
And oddly enough, last year when we had almost no snow right through the winter until well into January, it was October 31st, Halloween, that we got our first snow last year. So I haven't seen anything, not a flake, nothing that would tell me that it was snowing.
We did get some news, though, from our friend Karen at Owen Lake, and they saw their first skiff. Is that how she put it?
Yep.
Skiff of ice.
Yeah. There's been ice on my bird feeder, but on my bird bath. But I haven't seen anything on the lake that made me want to go find my skates. Not that they're hidden. I know exactly where they are, but,
yeah,
I'll be watching. I am watching, and so far nothing.
Karen's a great photographer. You see her work in Season Watch. She also has a photo of a sundog that she spotted yesterday. So.
And we can get sundogs any time of the year, but they're more common in the winter. It has to do with the angle of the sun relative to your perspective from Earth. And the lower the angle, I think it's got to be 22 or 23, somewhere in there, degrees. And it can happen in the summer, but it's going to be really early in the morning or really late at night. But in the wintertime, the angle is low enough that you get sundogs a lot, and you'll be able to get out and see them. And we'll talk about them, I'm sure, this winter when they become more prevalent.
Coming up before 7 o'clock, we're going to be bringing you some student phonology. I think, what was our number today? Nine?
Eight.
Eight reports. Yeah. We'll be bringing them to you this half hour and in our next hour as well. Lots going on for you on the Tuesday morning show, along with John's Phonology Report, some weather talk with Tornado Bob, and our friend Dr. Craig Bowron will be joining us. It's Movember.
Yeah. Yeah, Mental Health Month, Men's Mental Health Month.
Yeah.
It's a tough time of year for a lot of people, and, shortening days and the stress of holidays and whatnot. It can be a little difficult to get through it, but Craig is going to be here in the 8 o'clock hour and is going to help guide us through. He's written a wonderful book called Man Overboard, and it talks about men's health in general, and he's going to reflect on that, and it will be a really interesting conversation. We receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more, empowering inclusion and community through employment, special order pricing, and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
We do have a question of the week. It's, what's your must-have Thanksgiving dish? Share your recipes. You can text us at 218-326-1234. Sometimes that isn't for Thanksgiving. It feels like it's more of the nostalgia or the what your family has always had rather than the fanciest food ever. Mm. Like for some in our family, the cranberries had to be straight out of the can where you could see the can on there.
Oh, nice. I
remember a couple years where we tried to make some fancier ones with some orange zest and, you know, this whole thing's like, nope, where's the shape of the can? That's what we're looking
for. Can't see the lines from the inside of the can. Can't eat it. Not having that. Well, for me, it is stuffing, and it's not even a question. I mean, if you threw out the turkey and the mashed potatoes and the cranberries and squash and beans and all the rest of it, I'd still be happy. I'd be like, pass the stuffing, please.
What about the pie?
Like, pie's okay, but it's not stuffing.
Oh, wow.
Oftentimes, and this is the truth, in my family, when the pie came around, I would ask for another helping of stuffing.
Hmm.
I couldn't care less about pie when you've got stuffing to eat.
And is it a family recipe? Are you like the stovetop box?
I don't know that I've ever had the stovetop box. Okay. I can't recall. But my father-in-law made a wonderful stuffing, and my son has mastered his recipe, so it continues. But my parents, my mother, made a wonderful stuffing. I remember complaining bitterly about celery being in it because I wasn't a fan of celery. But you know what? Even now, I don't care. If it's stuffing, if it's bread stuffing and it's been in the turkey or been in the pan, and even better if it's been around the edge of the pan where it's kind of crispy, crunchy. Oh, man.
And gravy on it?
You can have your gravy. I don't care.
Wow.
I'm just, all right. Give me the stuffing.
Okay. There we go.
I never was a gravy fan at Thanksgiving, but I understand gravy because in the old days, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, when you bought a turkey, it was dry and the white meat was terribly dry. You could hardly choke it down without gravy. It was like the grease that got the stuff down your throat. And I never ate it. I never ate the white meat. I was always, give me the drumstick, give me the thigh. Yeah. I want the dark meat.
Me too. I
want
the dark
moist,
meat.
You know, give me the moist stuff. And so I didn't care for gravy. It wasn't that I just didn't like gravy. I just put it on my mashed potatoes maybe, but I never took a great boat of it. It never floated around on my plate. I was always kind of parsimonious about my gravy.
Wow. All right.
Give me the stuffing. Sorry.
Wow. Now we know.
Now you do know.
We'd love to hear from you this morning. 218-326-1234.
We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing mental health care in Minnesota. November is National Adoption Month. Highlighting the need for adoptive and foster care families, North Homes provides licensing and case management for those opening their heart and home. More information is available at northhomes.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coastal piece of the Tsleil-Waututh tribe's ancestral territory has been restored. The announcement coincides with the 47th anniversary of the tribe regaining federal recognition. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
27 acres of Cape Foulweather on the Oregon coast have been reacquired by the Confederated Tribes of Tsleil-Waututh Indians. The tribe purchased the land from the Mackenzie River Trust last month with a $2 million grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
It really is an amazing opportunity for us to become stewards again.
Angela Sondana is director of the tribe's Natural Resources Department. She hopes to reintroduce cultural burning to the coastal prairie section to rejuvenate its ecosystem.
Cape Foulweather is an incredibly diverse and sensitive ecological area. It's been a cultural gathering site for millennia.
Sondana says it's been a good year for the Tsleil-Wautuths. Last December, President Biden signed a bill sponsored by Representative Val Hoyle, restoring gathering, fishing, and hunting rights to the tribe on their ancestral lands.
And it will provide direct opportunity for tribal members to gather and resume subsistence harvest in the rocky coastline there.
The Tsleil-Waututh Reservation was established in 1855 by Congress and President Franklin Pierce. It was further diminished through land cessions. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Conservationists and tribes say they intend to sue the federal government if it does not take steps to protect a rare snail, which is threatened by a lithium mine. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
The Kings River Purg is tiny, about the size of the tip of a ballpoint pen, and it's found only in an area of Nevada called Thacker Pass, where there are plans to mine lithium, the key ingredient for electric car batteries. Paul Ruprecht is with the Western Watersheds Project. He says mining will shrink the small springs that the snail relies on.
The species is really vulnerable because fluctuations in water availability could really impact its ability to continue to exist in these areas.
The conservation group had previously petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the snail as endangered. The agency was supposed to make a decision this year, but never did. So the nonprofit and several tribes informed the government they intend to sue. The People of Red Mountain is a group of knowledge keepers from the Fort McDermitt Paiute, Shoshone, and Bannock tribes. They say they have a cultural responsibility to protect native species in the area. Federal officials now have until mid-January to respond. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Alaska's vote counting process will finally come to an end this Wednesday, but Nick Begich III is already declaring victory in his bid to unseat U.S. Representative Mary Peltola. Between Friday and Saturday, an additional 24,000 ballots were counted. Although they closed the gap between Peltola and her Republican challenger to about 8,300 votes, Begich still maintains a lead of more than 2 percentage points against Peltola. A candidate must have more than 50% of the vote to avoid ranked choice voting in Alaska. That's when the second choice votes of other candidates in the race are added to the totals. Although 318,000 ballots have been cast, Begich so far has failed to meet that threshold, so the race will likely be determined by ranked choice. Peltola, a Democrat, had a strong, well-financed campaign, but failed to overcome the coattail effect of Donald Trump's big win in Alaska, which boosted Begich's campaign. Meanwhile, a ballot measure that seeks to overturn Alaska's open primary and ranked choice voting system is passing by the slimmest of margins by only 0.2 percentage point. In August 2022, ranked choice voting helped Peltola win a special election to fill Congressman Don Young's seat after his death, making her the first Alaska Native to serve in Congress. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is
National Native News, thanks to them, it's produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is the Tuesday morning show. Thanks so much for being a part of it, listening in, sending us texts. We heard from Bill, who was out in the deer stand with a whole bunch of guys last week, and sent us the video from his nephew.
Yeah.
And that we saw the unmistakable loping.
Yes. the inimitable gait of a bear.
Right.
Whew. Yeah, and it's not unusual. Usually, it is probably a male, and it may have been just sleeping somewhere, and some hunter walked by, and it woke up and decided to move, or maybe it just hadn't settled in. Maybe it hadn't found that ideal spot, found its beauty rest spot yet. Support comes from FixCon Roofing. FixCon is committed to custom consultations for your roofing needs and is striving to serve communities in northern Minnesota. More information at fikscon.com. Support for KAXE comes from the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs. Awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More information at gracf.org.
Go along.
We need to back up and get some love directions. Love directions now. Where do we go from here, my dear? We've been together for too long to feel this lost and lonely. Yeah. Which is a path to take? I think we should stop and get some. Stop and get some love direction. Yeah. Love direction. We need to stop and get some, baby. Love direction. Hitting in the love direction.
Is The Dip. They're a six-piece rhythm and blues band from Seattle that play funk and soul and rock and roll. We heard Love Direction getting us going on this Tuesday morning.
Yeah, well, that was nice. Mm-hmm. I liked it. We receive support from the Grand Rapids State Bank, proudly serving the Grand Rapids area for 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And support comes from the Edge Center Gallery in Big Fork, now presenting an exhibit titled Sharing Native Heritage Through Art by painter Jason Two Feathers Hurdler and drum maker Chris Baldwin. Meet the artists at a reception from 5 to 7 p.m. on December 6th. More at edgecenterarts.org.
It's time for the favorite time of the week. Of the morning show for
my
me.
My favorite, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I get to hang out with John Latimer. We get to hear the student reports. It is a great time to just kind of settle in with your cup of coffee and learn something.
Yeah, here's what the kids are seeing around the country, around the state anyway. Funding for student phenology is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. Our first report this week comes from Emma Adams' class at Great Expectations Schools in Grand Marais.
Hi, this is B,
Lena,
Emily,
and
Grayson,
reporting from Great Expectations School in Grand Marais. On November 6th, students throughout the school have been reporting many more deer. Deer are currently in the rutting season. This is when the males are looking for females to mate with. They become a lot more active during this time.
There has also been reports of deer, moose, fox, crow, grouse, and chickadees. Ella and I have heard coyotes at their homes this week. The afternoons still
have been fairly warm. Monday, the high almost reached 60 degrees, but the mornings are cool.
The red maple at the school has completely lost its leaves, as have the alder and the birch. Some of the trees have a small number of leaves, but most have gone away. The beavers' class found some witch's butter fungus in the backwoods on a log. We noticed that the oxeye daisies are still out, but some of them have started to wilt.
This past weekend, Miss Emma had found a group of crows, two balgios, and a vulture. She went to a vet to get and found they were eating a moose that had died. She could see the food it had been eating. This has been
B, Lena,
Emily,
and Grayson reporting from Great Expectations Zoo.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, thank you, kids. What a nice report. B, Lena, Emily, and Grayson, good job. Couple of notes there. First of all, remember that that this was the week of November 6th, which explains the temperature of nearly 60 degrees. We haven't been close to 60 for a couple of weeks up here, at least a week and a half anyway. The red maple finally lost its leaves. You know, you have to remember that Grand Marais and that whole strip of coastline along Lake Superior is affected by that body of water right there. And that changes the phenology considerably. So the fact that the red maple by the school still had leaves on it in the first part of November is pretty surprising, except that it's not, because that is the nature of that big lake and its effect on the trees and plants in the area. Alder and paper birch also down, an oxeye daisy still blooming, and that's kind of what we would expect. And I like the idea, you know, you see crows and eagles and maybe even a turkey vulture, which is a little unusual. That turkey vulture was overstaying his visit, I would think. Most of them have moved south by now, but that one had a good source of food there and wasn't about to leave it and give it up, so good for him, and good for all of those animals. Bad for the moose, of course. Our next report comes from Allison Ofterheide's class at the Cherry School near Iron Junction.
Hi, this is
Bianca,
Mac,
Ava,
and Jolene,
reporting from Cherry School in Iron Junction, Minnesota, on November 14th, 2024. We have been noticing that it's chilly, windy, and getting colder as the days go on. A lot of kids have been deer hunting. We've been noticing a lot of deer, so we started to tally them. So far, there are 134 does and 48 bucks.
This is Jolene. On November 13th, I noticed a blue jay at my house in Cherry.
This is Ava. On November 13th, I saw two wolves, a black and white one. I heard them again the next morning on November 9th. Araya saw a pine marten in the tree growling at her when she was walking back from deer hunting.
This is Mac. Over the weekend, I saw like five or six turkeys eating something in the grass in Hibbing.
This is Bianca. This morning, I saw a black-capped chickadee at my house in Fail. It was eating from our bird feeder.
Yesterday, during our walk in the school forest, we noticed a patch of green ferns with brown spores. We found this interesting, so we read about it and found that it's a rock fern because it stays green in the winter and has brown spores called sori.
We also found a caterpillar in the leaves, and we heard a red squirrel. Oh, this concludes our phenology report. This has been Bianca,
Mac,
Ava,
and Jolene,
reporting from Cherry School.
Nature rules!
Nature does indeed rule. Thank you, kids. Nice report. Lots of interesting things in there. I love the fact that they're keeping a tally of the deer that they have seen. 134 does and 48 bucks. I'm guessing that 48 bucks, that's probably been reduced by a number of unfortunate ones that walked into the wrong spot. Blue jays definitely still in the area. These are probably, lots of blue jays migrate. And some of the blue jays migrate from up north and end up right here in northern Minnesota and spend the winter here thinking, this is a nice warm spot. I'll stay here for the winter. And You know, having a feeder really makes a difference for them. They can stay a lot further north if they have food. We saw two wolves, a black one and a white one. The black one, probably. The white one, probably gray. Reading David Meach's book on wolves, I think the only white wolves that he's ever come across, the truly white ones, are up on Ellesmere Island in northern Canada. And Araya saw a pine marten, which is really a thrill. I've only seen a few in my life, but they are coming back, and there are more and more of them. So maybe you'll be one of the lucky ones to see one of those. And turkeys in the Hibbing area, you know, 10 years ago, we would have been like, nah, couldn't have been. But now there are turkeys all over the area. Turkeys at my house, even. Black-capped chickadee, very nice. And walking in the forest, you know, now is the time to get out and look at what's green. And there are some green ferns out there. And the kids at Cherry got a chance to look, and they looked. They did some investigating. They looked underneath and found the spores and the sporophytes, the little spore-producing bodies. And that's a very interesting observation. And the fact that they got out and did some research on it was really encouraging. I love to hear that kind of stuff. Thanks, kids. Great report. Our next report comes from Rob Marone's class at Pike Lake Elementary School near Duluth.
Morning, my name is Andy, and this is our report for this week of November 10th, 2024 from Pike Lake Elementary School. My partner Ava and I spotted some bright orange stuff on our phenology walk. Mr. Marone told us that it was called orange jelly fungus, but he wouldn't tell us anything else. We discovered that when we touch it, it felt like jelly at first, but when the texture kicked in and it felt somewhat crinkly and kind of wrinkly on the inside. We learned that there are several types of jelly fungus in Minnesota.
Lily here. On Tuesday, I observed that pine needles can be green and yellow or brown. I wonder why it changes that color, just like how leaves change their color. I did some research, and they change color because when the tree gets old and it turns brown and the needles fall off to grow new needles. On Wednesday, I observed a bunny in my driveway. I saw that its color was lighter color. I think that the bunnies are changing colors because of how winter is coming and it is getting colder. I am wondering why they turn white. I did some research and learned that the white color is for camouflage. They change colors by shedding old brown fur and going back white.
Good morning, this is Brooks. This weekend, November 9th through the 11th, I went deer hunting in Brainerd, Minnesota. While I was hunting, I noticed a chipmunk eating and chewing on oak bark. I was wondering why it was chewing on the bark, so I did a little research. My research said that it is normal for chipmunks to chew on bark. They chew on bark mainly to build their nests, but the bark does have some nutrients inside. I realized that maybe it was getting ready for the winter because maybe the poor little chipmunk couldn't get enough food and nuts for the winter. I also realized that the first day of hunting in the morning, the deer were moving a lot. We had 11 deer encounters, but in the next 3 days, we had two, but we did end up shooting two in the 4 days we were there.
I am Nicholas. We think the large buck in our school forest was harvested by a hunter in the area. I think the 11-point buck got shot because we have not seen it for a long time. Smaller bucks are showing up on our trail cameras. We also know that a neighbor got a 10-point. I am hoping I can still get my first deer.
Emily here. Last Wednesday, I was flabbergasted, and I saw a loon on the Grand Lake paddling alongside the dock. And on Friday, right after school, I saw something so spectacular. A big male bald eagle perched right up on my chicken's fencing. Not only did it look hungry, but it was also much bigger than most eagles. This concludes our report from the outer reaches of the Proctor School District. Be aware.
Things are happening out there.
They sure are, and you're sitting right on top of it and getting a good look at all of it. That's wonderful. I love the fact that Mr. Marone will not tell us anything more, and we had to go and do research, and they did, and they researched a lot of little subjects there, which is wonderful because they will remember those things. The young lady who saw the bunny that was turning white, there are two kinds of, I'll call them rabbits here in northern Minnesota. There is the cottontail rabbit and there is the snowshoe hare. And though they look a lot alike, they have a lot of differences.